Okay, good evening. I'd like to call the Wednesday, August 14th, 2019 meeting of the Oceano Community Services District to order. May we have a roll call, please?
Director Gibson?
Present.
Director Villa?
Present.
Director Opogo?
Here.
Vice President White?
Here.
President Austin?
Here. Will you all please join me in the pledge? I pledge allegiance to the of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Okay, that will bring us to our agenda review. Is there anything that anyone wants to switch or change on the agenda?
President Austin,
yes.
Members of the board, we have a modified agenda item 8B for you. The revised version is the revised staff report with the yellow highlights. So we have added $275,259.82 to this warrant. We received the Five Cities Fire invoice for the first quarter. That invoice reflects the amount that was budgeted in the workshop, not the final preliminary. Well, it's just the preliminary budget. The final budget would be at your next meeting. So for the next three quarters, we will get the increase so that the total for Five Cities Fire budget will be the $1,138,148. So we're not receiving a discount, which we thought, but we're not. So it'll be the amount that was agreed to on that budget. So that's what is reflected on the back of the sheet. Another item is the workers' comp line item, and that is for an audit that we're bringing back to them, and we have talked to them about where we think we owe less, but we have to pay them to keep our workers' comp, so we don't want that to lapse at all. So we'll get that back after the workers' comp audit's complete, and then I will report back to you on that. So with that, if there's any other items or questions.
Excuse me. On agenda item number 9B, consideration of adopting a social media policy. You also have handouts on edits for that, so there will be a staff recommendation, but as a business item, we'll discuss that at the appropriate time.
Okay. Okay, then that will bring us to our item number 5, closed session, conference with legal counsel regarding Santa Maria Valley Water Conservation District versus City of Santa Maria et al. Did you want to say anything before I open the public comment? Or?
No, thank you.
Okay. Uh-huh. Is there any public comment on the closed session item? Okay, seeing none, then we will. How long do you think we'll be out?
10 minutes.
10 minutes.
And pursuant to Government Code 54956.9A, the board will adjourn to closed session for conference of legal counsel regarding the Santa Maria Valley Water Conservation District versus the City of Santa Maria et al.
Okay, we'll be back.
they got it back on, and just watched it.
The water pressure?
Yeah.
Yeah, I got a pressure on my little well. And
yeah, you remember that when they flushed the toilet? It's perfect.
Okay, I'd like to call the meeting back to order, and if our legal counsel can give us a report out of closed session, please.
The report out of closed session is no reportable action.
Okay, thank you. That brings us to our special presentations, and tonight we have an update. Oh, public comment on matters not on the agenda. Is there anyone here for public comment not on the agenda? Okay, seeing none. That brings us to our special presentations and reports. And we have an update on the Central Coast Blue by, what was his?
President Austin. So tonight, Dan Heimel with WSC Consultants and Ben Fine, Public Works Director for Pismo Beach, are here. I think Dan will be doing the presentation. And as a quick note, the presentation is a little bit truncated from the version that was provided in the agenda package, shortened a little bit. He has both presentations on the computer, though, and there's, in case you might have a question on a slide that he doesn't cover during the presentation, he can bring that slide up and answer questions on the version that was in your agenda package. And I believe we posted the revised version on the website today as well. So with that.
Yeah, good reminder, Papa. I loaded that other version, but I have it here, so we can get to it if we need it.
Oh, no.
She had it. Yeah, Carrie had it loaded, too.
Ah, yeah.
Get the lights? Yeah.
Thanks, Pavo. President Austin, members of the Oceana Community Services District Board of Directors, thanks for the opportunity to come here today and provide an update on the Central Coast Blue Project. My presentation will cover these five primary areas. First off, why Central Coast Blue? Then I'll provide a project status update. I'll give an overview of some of the cost-benefit sharing frameworks being discussed amongst the agencies, talk about next steps, and then wrap up with a project schedule overview. So why is Central Coast Blue? The recent drought recently highlighted the vulnerabilities in the five cities' supply water supplies. And as this board, I'm sure, knows, that water supply portfolio is made up of state water, Lopez Lake, or local surface water, and then groundwater from the Santa Maria Groundwater Basin. The drought really highlighted the vulnerabilities of the groundwater basin and the potential for seawater intrusion. So historically, the threat of groundwater intrusion has been identified going back as far as the 1970s in a DWR report that identified potential pathways and contamination areas in the Northern Cities management area portion of the Santa Maria groundwater basin. And then more recently, in 2009, evidence of seawater intrusion was detected in two monitoring wells located actually here in Oceano, as highlighted on this map.
So I know that you're aware of this letter from the Oceano CSD Board in 2012 stating that they did not believe that seawater intrusion being reported at one of those wells was actually seawater intrusion. It was due to deterioration of the well itself. So why is that data continuing to be cited?
So I am aware of that letter. Do we want to address questions through the presentation? Or I can take that question. But
so maybe we could hit that one. I think it would probably be a good question to answer up front, and I can help with the answer because... But other than that, it might be good to have Dan go through the presentation and then save questions for afterwards.
Really up to the board's preference.
Yeah.
I'm open to either.
I'm just thinking about timing because if we, you know, that's one of the pressing questions that I know exists right now. So I like the idea of addressing that question. But just for timing-wise, if it's possible for the board to save other questions until the end, that would be great.
My preference would be to do it as we go along. It seems to flow better, but it's up
to the
board. Or
maybe we can play it by ear, because...
I like the idea of an overview.
And some questions end up getting answered later during the presentation. With respect to the data in 2009... I wasn't with Oceano at the time. I understood that there was two different possible sources of contamination on those particular test data. Even when I was with County Public Works, I questioned a conclusion that it was seawater intrusion as opposed to surface contamination into the wells. I think that there's a couple of things that after 2009 or after 2012 have come up. One is it was detected in two different wells and not one well. Pumping prior to 2009 was more significant than the pumping most recently. Overall, the groundwater modeling, my understanding is, does sort of reinforce the idea that that might have actually been seawater intrusion in 2009. But I kind of step back and I say, in some respects, whether it was factually, if the interpretation of the data was really seawater intrusion or if it's not seawater intrusion, I'm not sure how relevant 2009 and 2012 is anymore, because certainly we know that the pumping capabilities of the basin are significantly reduced, and we know that we have real threats of seawater intrusion. So... I think that, you know, those of us or amongst us or outside of this room might interpret that 2009 data differently. I'm just not sure that it's really super relevant in moving forward, because we know that the threats exist and we know that we should be very concerned about the health of the groundwater basin. And I don't think that... that 2009 data is really important for justifying the need for Central Coast Blue either. And if it's a distraction on needs, then maybe we need to talk about it less and just talk about what we know about the groundwater basin overall right now. Those are my thoughts and responses on that question.
I can add that, you know, there was quite a bit of analysis that went into looking at what occurred in 2009, the groundwater conditions at that point, the water quality parameters that were detected, and it was the consensus opinion of the Northern Cities Management Area Technical Group that that incident was a seawater intrusion incident. And that was, there have been at least three certified hydrogeologists that have worked with that group since that time that have all corroborated. The detection of the seawater intrusion has been documented in the annual reports going back, you know, at least the last 8 years. And it continues to be the consensus of the opinion of the technical group, which is staff-level technical representatives for each of the NCMA agencies, which I'm sure the board is aware, the local cities of Arroyo Grande, Gober Beach, Pismo Beach, and the Oceano Community Services District, that seawater intrusion was detected there and that it is a threat to the basin. And additionally, as Paavo described, the groundwater modeling effort that was done over the last 2 years corroborated that there were conditions within the groundwater basin where the model predicts onshore flow or flow of water from the offshore portion of the aquifer onshore in the time preceding 2009, and then those conditions were reversed after 2009, largely due to two factors we attributed it to. One was the significant reduction in municipal groundwater pumping that occurred in response to the detection, and then two was improved hydrologic conditions in the water year 2010-2011. So to help better understand the impacts of reduced groundwater levels and potential seawater intrusion, and to better understand potential pathways for seawater intrusion. The NCMA agency's developed a groundwater model. This is just a figure that shows a 3D representation of the northern portion of the Santa Maria groundwater basin. And as I just described, the groundwater model identified potential pathways for seawater intrusion into the lower Paso Robles and upper Carriaga formations, highlighted by these arrows shown here. And these formations happen to be the two portions of the aquifer that the municipal agencies rely on for most of their groundwater production. And as I described, it additionally showed onshore flow in the time period preceding 2009. So sort of overall general findings from the groundwater modeling effort was that during periods of extended drought, the NCMA agency's ability to pump their full allotment of groundwater is limited because of the threat of seawater intrusion. So as a result of that, to help better understand these impacts, the agencies developed a water supply demand evaluation tool so that it could look at the available water supply and potential demands under a variety of different drought and future demand scenarios. And so this tool creates an output, as shown here, and this is just a representative output. It doesn't represent a water supply or demand for any specific agency, but it's a tool to be able to look and identify if an agency or a region would have water supply surpluses or deficit under different drought condition scenarios. And so just to orientate you to this, the colored columns represent the different water supply, and the different colors represent the different components of the water supply. So the orange represents the amount of state water that would be available, blue the amount of groundwater basin or groundwater that would be available from the Santa Maria Basin, and green the amount of Lopez water. And then the horizontal bars represent the potential demand from the urban water management plans. And so anytime we see that there is a gap between the available supply in a given scenario and the anticipated demand, that implies that there would be a potential water deficit in that drought scenario. And anytime the columns exceed or go above the demand lines, then that indicates a surplus. And so this was a tool that the agencies used to evaluate their individual water supplies, and it identified that there's a potential for water supply deficits during extended drought conditions. And supplemental water can help fill that gap. So a number of supplemental water supply alternative studies were completed since 2012, and each of those included an alternatives analysis that looked not only at recycled water, but other water supply alternatives to help improve water supply reliability in the region. And the results of those studies pointed to recycled water as the preferred alternative. And so this is a table showing the different unit costs for the various water supply alternatives. And while recycled water, shown here in the red circles, isn't necessarily the cheapest unit cost, it had the greatest value when taking into account all the other considerations. Like the Lopez Lake spillway has a lower unit cost, but that would require that the lake actually fills and spills, which it hasn't done since the late 90s. So we wouldn't have received any benefit over the last 20 years. So given these findings, the concept of Central Coast Blue was developed. And so Central Coast Blue will capture a water source that is currently wasted to the ocean and use it to protect the groundwater basin and improve water supply reliability. So here's a figure showing the existing water treatment process that occurs at the Pismo Beach Wastewater Plant as well as here at the South San Luis County Sanitation District. The water is treated to secondary standards and discharged to the ocean. With Central Coast Blue, that treatment process would be expanded to include advanced treatment. Three additional treatment process steps would be included to treat the water to sufficient quality that it could be injected into the groundwater basin, where that water would reside for a period of several months to several years before being pumped out through the existing production wells and served to the NCMA community. An additional benefit to injecting that water in the groundwater basin, other than increasing groundwater recharge, is the development of a seawater intrusion barrier So here's a cross-sectional schematic diagram of how that barrier could work. And I apologize, the contrast is a little hard to see, I think, on some of the different colors here. But advanced treated water would be distributed to a series of injection wells that would then inject into the groundwater basin and create what is shown here is a seawater intrusion barrier or ridge of higher water that would be sufficient in pressure to keep the seawater from intruding into the basin. That would then allow the production wells, which are located inland, to pump groundwater without the threat or by minimizing the threat of seawater intrusion. Central Coast Blue would leverage existing infrastructure. We were just talking about this before the meeting. So wastewater is treated at the City of Pismo Beach Wastewater Treatment Plant and is piped all the way down to the South San Luis County facility where it's discharged into a joint outfall. And so that's, this pipeline can really help connect both facilities and enable a regional project. Central Coast Blue is envisioned to be implemented in multiple phases. So the first phase would include capture and treatment of Pismo Beach's wastewater, and then the second phase would bring in water from the South San Luis County Sanitation District's wastewater plant. And the injection scenarios for phase one and two are shown here on this slide. So just to help orientate everybody, well, before I get started, this is obviously an aerial image of the Oceano area and portions of Grover Beach. I think the airport you can see down there is a good landmark to orientate where we are. So seawater intrusion was detected in these two wells in 2009. The municipal production wells are located inland from those wells. And so Central Coast Blue in phase one would inject groundwater into this series of injection wells, primarily located along Highway 1 with one well at the Sand District's wastewater treatment plant. That injection would create that barrier, as I described previously, to allow the municipal production wells, which reside inland, to pump without inducing seawater intrusion. Phase 2 of the project, as currently envisioned, would include the construction of two new wells and increased injection rates to the five existing wells. But all injected primarily here along this corridor. Or potentially a component where recycled water could be delivered to agriculture, most likely in the Cienega Valley. The supply-demand analysis graphs that I showed earlier were primarily showing phase one. And so that analysis indicates that phase one is likely enough water to provide the level of water supply reliability that the region needs in the near term. An implementation of phase two, or treatment and putting to beneficial use of the water from the sand district, may not be needed in the short term. And phase two implementation will likely depend on a number of factors, including climate change, resiliency of the other water supply sources, agricultural interest in the water, the ability to sell or transfer surplus water when the water purveyors have it available, the effectiveness of phase one, and then future demand by participating or neighboring agencies. So with that, I'll transition to the project update portion of the presentation.
Dan? So this is a good, maybe it is a good opportunity to cover some questions on what's been discussed so far. I know I had a quick one or two. In terms of the groundwater modeling, can you remind us how that was paid for?
So groundwater modeling was paid for through a real combination of different sources. I would say that the primary source for funding the groundwater model was supplemental environmental program settlement funds with the Sand District for the spill event that it had in 2011. So the Sand District negotiated with the regional board to be able to use some of its fine money to support a local project to improve water supply reliability. And I think that contributed $220,000 to the groundwater modeling effort. The City of Pismo Beach also contributed funding to the groundwater modeling effort. And then additionally, the San Luis Obispo Flood Control and Water Conservation District Zone 3 contributed funding to the effort as well.
Okay, so some ways, you know, no direct expenditures out of Oceano and maybe not out of AG and Grover either. Obviously, some of the costs incurred ultimately through the fines at the Sand District and money through Zone 3 includes taxpayer money from everybody. I just kind of wanted to draw out the point that these groundwater modeling can be expensive endeavors, and I thought it was a good job on the project team to be able to bring in money from different sources and reduce the fiscal impact to us and some of the other agencies. And then the other thing that Dan talked a little bit about in terms of the modeling, he mentioned the Carioca and the Paso Robles formations, which are basically where the municipal pumps are. In contrast, our ag in the Cienega Valley is really pumping out a creek alluvium. So there's some dynamics there that would lend themselves to further analysis. The pumping up on the Mesa is more out of the Paso Robles and Carioca formations as well. And could they be impacting our supplies in the municipal areas kind of underneath the creek alluvium from ag? And so that and combined with separately, well, okay, still ag's pumping from the creek alluvium, and is that reducing recharge into Carioca and Paso Robles formations the more that they pump? So the groundwater basin modeling is, so far what's been done, has provided really good information associated with the basin and our overall reliability and concerns thereof, but there's still a lot more information that could be developed associated with the basin as time goes by.
And I had one question.
Sure.
I would think with you putting so much of that water back in right at the ocean front, so to speak, a lot of it's going to run out to the ocean. Why don't you consider putting part of it back further east?
Yeah,
it just seems like, I mean, I know you're doing a saltwater protection, but mm-hmm. at the same time, it's all going to run into the ocean from there, isn't it?
Yeah, so that was a good thought and good insight, and actually something that we looked at in the model. Bear with me. So a couple of the concepts there, you're right. If you put it near the ocean, you are going to lose some that's going to go out to the ocean. The reality, we need water going out to the ocean. That's what's protected the basin in the past. But yeah. But what we found is when you actually run the model, because you're pumping inland here with these production wells, you're able to capture a good portion of that water before it runs out to the ocean. So you do have a gradient going this way, but you also have a gradient going this way, and so some of that water will flow back inland. We looked at several scenarios where we actually injected further inland and didn't find as promising results, and also had to extend pipelines inland, so there were additional costs associated with that. And then I guess the third point, what we found is by creating this barrier along the coastline, It generates the ability for the agencies to more flexibly use these production wells. And so even though you're not necessarily recovering every molecule that gets injected, you're getting a greater yield on your groundwater supply by creating that barrier and being able to withdraw water from the inland.
You're damming it up in the back end.
Yeah. Yeah. And part of that is because this basin recovers very quickly. As we talked about, there was a drought preceding 2010-11. 2010-11, we had one wet year, and groundwater levels recovered significantly and then unfortunately declined with the last drought before 2017, when they recovered quickly again. So being able to access that storage and then letting it refill with natural recharge is a benefit as well.
Okay. Thank you.
And if I might add just a little bit, what I've heard in the discussions that has caught my ear is that, especially in dry periods, by having the seawater intrusion, the inland wells, we can actually pump deeper than we could otherwise. And so that flexibility Dan had spoken to was the ability, when necessary, to draw the wells down further. When we do that, then it creates more space, basically, in the groundwater basin to get recharged when the droughts are over.
Yeah.
So.
Several questions. The slides aren't numbered, but it's the one that's titled Groundwater Model Findings. It says the supply-demand analysis tool incorporated the following. And the last two are potential demand reductions from conservation and potential increased demand from future growth. So what specifically were those assumptions? How much conservation and how much growth were going into that model?
Yeah, so we what we observed, and I'm sure all your organization observed as well, as we went into this extended drought, the local residents and businesses exhibited a significant ability to conserve, both voluntarily and in some ways, you know, were forced by water conservation regulations. And so we wanted to account for that because so these projections here, the gray and black lines are from the urban water management plans, and they don't necessarily account for the levels of water conservation that were achieved in this latest drought. And so we built in the ability to reduce ground or water demand to account for that level of conservation. And the other thing we included on these graphs is this 2015 column. And that was really at the peak of the drought where agencies were using as little water as possible. And so we wanted to put that in there to show how low an agency could get its demand and compare that relative to the available supply in the other scenarios.
So was there like a percentage
assumption
of conservation and a corresponding percentage growth that you were
so using? Growth was based off of, and I apologize for not addressing the growth portion of the question, was based off growth estimates from the urban water management plans or other slow cog, because the district doesn't have an urban water management plan because they're not required to based on their population and service connections. But based on slow cog, San Luis Obispo Council of Governments, I believe, population estimates, and so that was sort of the best available growth data we had available to us. And then the conservation really was left variable and in some ways left up to the individual agency to be able to manipulate depending on how much they thought that their community could conserve.
Do you know what those specific
numbers
were?
So, like in this roughly? Model, I mean, I think we had, it depended on which drought scenario, but I think the greatest one we got was down to 30% conservation. But it's really tied to what's your baseline. You know, what are you assuming you're starting at? If you're starting at, you know, 2008 levels or 1990 levels,
For example, I thought I heard Arroyo Grande speaking in our meeting the other day that their per capita consumption went from about 160 gallons per capita per day down to under 120, maybe in the teens, gallons per capita per day. So I'd assume then that those conservation levels are what, not just assume, this is what Shane was saying, is that those efforts, those conservation measures are incorporated now into their drought contingency plans and their urban water management plans in order to see what is the demand that they would anticipate in drought situations. So to me, that's the most significant, you know, quantity of conservation that I've seen. Part of it was because Arroyo Grande was actually using, you know, a fairly significant amount of water on a per capita basis prior to the drought, and so their conservation efforts had more room for savings versus Oceano itself. We've been under 100 gallons per capita per day for quite some time, and I think we're running at 70-ish right now. Can't recall off the top of my head, but we have less room to reduce consumption on a percentage basis because the community is also already very conservation-oriented.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then as to the growth, do you have any idea approximately what percentage population growth was being assumed?
I don't have those specific numbers, but we can definitely provide those. Slow cog estimates.
I'd like to know what was assumed.
Okay.
I wasn't done yet. Oh, okay. Sorry. Then a few pages later, the one that's titled Supplemental Water Supply Studies identified recycled water as the preferred alternative. Can you just explain some of those titles? What is secondary minus 23 irrigation?
Yeah, and this could probably be better labeled to make it more clear. So the secondary 23 irrigation, that is what we call non-potable recycled water, or so it's use of recycled water for landscape irrigation. And the secondary 23 implies it's sort of the lowest level of water that you can use for irrigation, so there's very restricted uses. I think you can use it on cemeteries and private golf courses or something. The tertiary irrigation, that's a higher level of treatment, but it's still non-potable, meaning it's not for drinking, and that you can use on almost any landscape irrigation. According to the, there are rules that it's hard to use on residences, but you can use on parks and schools and other public facilities.
If I could jump in real quick, Dan, so just qualitatively, the reason why those two are much more expensive is because the cost of facilities in comparison to how much you can actually apply. And so for secondary 23 irrigation, we're still talking about a lot of pipes. We're talking not as extensive treatment as under Central Coast Blue, but still additional treatment costs, additional pipes, but very limited applications of how many acre feet. So it's the numerator-denominator game, and it becomes expensive on a per-acre-foot basis. The overall yield of benefit, too, is limited. And then to a certain degree, that's the same story with tertiary, just not as bad as secondary 23. It's the higher levels of treatment where you actually have enough treatment to inject it into the groundwater basin where you can use more, recycle more water, get it out there for beneficial use, and reduce the cost on a per-unit basis.
So how much additional treatment does the secondary 23 get versus the secondary treatment that the Sand District is doing now, for example?
So secondary 23 doesn't necessarily require a lot of additional treatment infrastructure, but you need to be able to achieve certain pathogen limits with your secondary water. And unlikely that I think the existing facility could meet those limits. I believe the city of Pismo Beach tried to meet those limits just, through their treatment process, which was just more robust than the Sand District's process at this point. And I don't believe you were able to quite get there on the secondary 23 standards.
You have to hit it for 7 days straight. You were able to sustain it for 5 to 6 days.
Yeah, but again, to Pablo's point, your application for that water at that level of treatment where you can use it is really very limited.
Okay. And how about conservation, additional conservation? Did this factor in here at all as a way to...
Additional conservation really got factored into the supply-demand analysis. This really is looking at the point that you identify you need a supplemental supply, even though you've accounted for conservation, then these are the costs of the options available to you.
How about direct potable reuse?
So I'm not sure that we included a cost for direct potable reuse here. One of the challenges with direct potable reuse is there's not currently a regulatory pathway in California for direct potable reuse. They're working on it. There's not necessarily any specific timelines for when direct potable reuse will be an option available to California communities. It potentially could lower costs. The levels of treatment would still be the same, if not higher, plus much more additional monitoring and scrutiny. And then what we've looked at is that you may still get a greater benefit through injection than you would by direct potable reuse and putting it in the pipes because of, as Pavo described, the ability to create that barrier and better manage access to your groundwater storage.
Are you familiar with the Pure Water Project in San Diego?
San Diego Pure, yeah.
So if they're proceeding with direct potable reuse there, right?
They are doing another form of recycled water, and it's not quite direct potable reuse. What they are doing is what we call reservoir augmentation. And so they're taking water that would be treated to similar levels as what's proposed for Central Coast Blue, and they're putting it in a surface water body reservoir where it mixes and resides before it then goes to a surface water treatment plant. So an equivalent of that in this area would be taking the water and putting it into Lopez Reservoir and then pulling it out, treating it again, and delivering it. And so that's been looked at in several of these studies. The challenge with that has been the length of piping that would be required to get it up there.
I can't recall if the San Diego project had special legislation associated with it. There's something that I thought I had heard that, you know, as a pilot program or something that they were getting some special consideration.
I'm not aware of special legislation, but I think they definitely, you know, and given the number of people and the budgets available to them, they kind of pushed the industry and the regulators in that direction. The challenge with potable reuse in San Diego is they don't have groundwater basins that would support a project like Central Coast Blue. They rely almost wholly on surface water supplies, and so really the only option available to them to capture their wastewater and treat it and use it for drinking water was surface water augmentation or direct potable reuse, which is even another further step.
Okay, and the desal on this chart, was that seawater desal or brackish water desal? Or what did
this
you
was seawater desal, yeah.
Did you look at brackish water desal?
I don't believe brackish water desal was evaluated. Or, yeah, it's not included in this table.
That would be less expensive, generally.
The brackish water being less expensive? Yeah, I'm not sure. Do you have any industry sense on that? Because I do know that when you have pick up brackish water, you tend to pick up more organics, and then you have additional treatment challenges because of those, filtering challenges and stuff. Morro Bay, when they did their desal project in the last drought, after the drought, they spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to deal with the organics that they were picking up, because you got to get them out of the water stream, otherwise they're going to foul up the membranes and everything. Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, trade-offs between the two.
Maybe dependent on the water source.
Yeah, it could be, yeah.
And then on the Central Coast Blue injection scenarios, with the aerial view of Oceano there, I was wondering why you chose locations along Highway 1. That's our main street through town, and we've probably, as a community, would prefer not to have ugly industrial infrastructure along there.
You wouldn't have any.
Yeah, so these are just the injection wells, but the majority of this is below ground. And these are located, I don't know the full character of the community, but they would be located in areas, ideally, out of sight with limited impact. The reason they're located there is to achieve the benefits of the project that you're targeting. They have to be near the coastline because that's where you need your barrier. They need to be west of the existing municipal production wells. And the further away you get from the sand district plant, the more expensive the project gets is the additional pipeline that's required to move them further inland.
Visual impacts are going to be addressed, I assume, during EIR and coastal development. And I know that when we worked on Los Osos, we had a number of situations that had visual impacts, too, that were then mitigated through design objectives.
Yeah, I would add that these potentially can be constructed, or at least the sort of what I call above ground components, the infrastructure can be put below ground. They can be built in vaults, basically. Obviously, the well extends, you know, way below the ground surface, but the infrastructure required to support the well can be actually built in vaults, and we've seen examples of that in Orange County with their groundwater replenishment project.
Thank you. That's okay. All the questions I had.
Thank you. Anyone else have any questions? Okay, we'll go on.
Okay. Central Coast Blue project update. Again, I apologize, this is a little hard to see, but the main point we're trying to show here is where Central Coast Blue is in the project life cycle. So Central Coast Blue is currently in the preliminary engineering phase and will be entering the environmental review or the EIR phase in the next couple of months. And so a lot of these questions about impacts, visual impacts, those will all be evaluated in the EIR phase. There'll be opportunities for public comments and board comments throughout that phase. Following that, then the project would enter the permitting phase, the final design, before going through funding and then ultimately into construction. And I have a better slide where we can talk about the specific dates and schedules for all that. Advanced treatment siting. So the project team is evaluating multiple locations for siting the advanced treatment facility, including what we call on-site, or the South San Luis County Sanitation District's wastewater plant. So when I say on-site, I'm referring to siting the advanced facility there. Again, water from both Pismo and the South County plant flows to that location, so it makes sense from certain engineering perspectives. But also looking at an off-site location. And so here's an image of Northwest Oceano and Southwest Grover Beach and some areas that have been highlighted or targeted for potential siting of an off-site advanced treatment facility. Both alternatives, an on and an off-site, will be evaluated as co-equals in the EIR. And just an update on the off-site, Pismo Beach has entered into a purchase agreement to secure an off-site property location for evaluation in the EIR as one of the alternatives. Another update, brine discharge can be a concern of projects like this. There is a reverse osmosis component that does create a concentrate discharge that would continue to be discharged out into the ocean. To understand the impacts of that, the project team utilized the availability of the advanced treatment pilot facility. Hopefully some of you had a chance to tour that at the City of Pismo Beach's wastewater plant. They had a pilot scale facility of the advanced treatment process. And so water quality samples from the concentrate stream were collected and analyzed to better understand potential impacts. And the results of that were that the concentrate stream would be able to meet current and anticipated future ocean plan water quality permit limits. Another status update is the development of updated cost estimates. And so this is a table here showing the latest available cost estimates for the project. A couple things I would say: that these cost estimates are developed for the on-site alternative. And they will likely change. As I described, we're in a preliminary engineering phase of the project. We're going to be going through an environmental review phase where additional conditions and other requirements will impact costs for the project. And they're shown here as a range as a result of that. But just sort of high level, capital costs potentially in the $28 to $50 million annual costs, total annual costs, including capital repayment and O&M, at $3.6 to $5.5 million. And then unit costs around $2,300 to $4,900 per acre foot. I would say that these cost estimates don't currently account for the potential for grant funding, which the project has been successful in obtaining, and I'll talk to that later. And there's potential for more. Then they also assume a 5% interest rate on financing, which we are very hopeful that we'll be able to get a much lower rate through state revolving fund financing through the State Water Resource Control Board. And then an additional, and I forgot to mention at the beginning, these are the costs for phase one. I would also point out that these costs for phase one are represent the costs to build the facility and the pipelines to accommodate phase two. So you're putting in larger pipelines than you would be required for phase one. You're building a building that is sized to accommodate phase two. And so if there's an alternative where the project moves forward with just phase one, these costs could come down, which would reduce all the line items, basically. And then phase two costs are shown here, again, for the on-site facility. The thing to point out here, these phase two costs are cumulative, so they include the phase one costs. We don't add the costs from the previous slide to these costs. This would be the cost to implement the full project, phase one and phase two, with a total capital of $40 to $80 million. Annual of $9 to $11 million, and then a unit cost of $2,100 to $2,500 Important to note that those unit costs for phase two are significantly lower, or they don't have as wide of a range. That is attributed to two factors. One, you get economies of scale with phase two. Now you're treating much more water. And two, you already built a lot of the infrastructure for phase two. Again, those larger pipelines, you built the building in phase one, and so those costs aren't burdened on phase two. This would be another opportunity to stop, or I can keep rolling.
Anyone have any questions?
I don't.
Yes, you do.
Go ahead.
So the alternative site, where is that? Which one of those areas?
So the alternative site that's being evaluated is located here in Grover Beach. Ben, do you want to? Yeah, I believe it is this parcel right here, next to Huber Street. And the siting for the off-site location, there were several criteria that we evaluated. Outside the coastal zone, outside the floodplain, but still in close proximity to the existing infrastructure to limit overall project costs, primarily associated with pipelines back and forth.
And why is it that the alternative and the South County Sanitation District locations are being evaluated as co-equals, given that the Sanitation District site is in the coastal zone and in the floodplain, and it's probably going to have to relocate because of sea level rise in the next few decades. Also factor in the opposition that you're likely to get from the California Coastal Commission, the Water Board, Surf Rider, Oceana residents.
So I can probably take that one. The, under CEQA, if you have a preferred site, you're not required to evaluate the alternatives to the same level of scrutiny as your preferred site. Under federal review, you have to do co-equal analysis and basically put the different sites to the same level of scrutiny. In prior projects, I've recommended co-equal analysis where siting is uncertain or controversial, just to make sure that both sites are both evaluated under the same level of scrutiny. But it doesn't mean that the ultimate recommendation is going to go to one site or another. It's simply to make sure. Also, the likelihood of federal funding coming in down the road means that doing co-equal analysis at this point in time will help meet the federal NEPA requirements if federal funding comes involved. So in some ways, it's making sure that there's a level playing field on both sites that are being considered.
Okay. And are you considering a third alternative site? Are you still looking, or is it just down to these two?
The project team's been looking for alternative sites. Yeah, it would be great to have more than two. There's been just a number of challenges in identifying one off-site location, and so. But I guess I would say that there's a site in Aurora Grande that's under consideration, but its location is significantly further away from the existing infrastructure, so the cost of pumping the water back and forth is going to likely be much higher.
So again, in considering additional sites, with two primary sites being co-equal, the other sites may also be considered, but they just might not be considered at the same level of scrutiny because there might be a constraint that rules them out early.
Okay, thank you. On the next slide, where you talk about the brine analysis, the last sentence is, pilot plant effluent can meet current permit and ocean plan discharge requirements without need for South San Luis Obispo County Sanitation District dilution. So does that mean if there was no flow from Oceano, AG, and Grover, that it would still meet the effluent discharge requirements?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure I was following that. All right, that's all I had.
Okay. Cost-benefit sharing framework. Just want to start off. Interagency collaboration has been key to project success to date. I think we hit on that a little bit with the groundwater model. But there's been a number of other cost-sharing agreements that have allowed the project to get to the point where it is today, including a 50-50 cost share on the EIR between the City of Pismo Beach and the Sand District. Again, all the cost sharing that went into the groundwater model. And then preliminary engineering has included cost sharing from Pismo, Grover Beach, and Arroyo Grande. And the project team and the participating agencies are really evaluating multiple funding options for this project. And the two primary options are looking at water and wastewater and the potential for funding the project through water and wastewater rates. And there's a potential split between those agencies. Third funding source that's been being evaluated and has actually been successfully obtained and for planning phases is outside funding or grant or low-interest financing to reduce the overall costs to the local water and wastewater customers, and I'll talk more about that later. So the general cost-sharing framework that's being evaluated and discussed is some split between water and wastewater. So here's a pie chart showing the different communities and water, wastewater utilities. And so you'll notice that, if you can see it, there's Oceana, Grover, and Arroyo Grande are shown as water utilities. Pismo Water is shown as a separate piece of the pie, and wastewater, because Pismo has a water and wastewater separate fund. And so the project team is evaluating a cost split between water and wastewater, and that's really tied to the benefits to those entities or agencies. So if they're the benefits to a wastewater organization like the Sand District or the Pismo Wastewater Fund would be tied to a specific cost share in the project. And so that they have a piece of the pie. And then that wastewater cost component would be further split between the Sand District and Pismo Wastewater. And what's being discussed is that split would be based on flow, just how much flow are you contributing to the outfall. And then a water split would be potentially based on groundwater allocations, because ultimately the benefits of the project are going to be in improved groundwater reliability. And so this is the general framework that's being evaluated, and you know, there's quite a bit of work to be done and discussions to be had to develop these specific percentages, but overall this is a general framework under consideration. Just a little bit about grant funding. As I mentioned before, the project has been successful in pursuing and obtaining grant funding, including $2 million in planning grant funding from the Prop 1 groundwater grant program. That funding is currently funding some initiatives that are underway to improve our understanding of the groundwater basin. And then the project will be pursuing Prop 1 groundwater grant funding round 3 implementation funds. So the planning grant funds were maxed out at $2 million. However, when you're pursuing implementation funds, the project could be eligible up to 50% of the capital cost. So that ranges anywhere from $15 to $25 million in grant funding that could be obtained to support implementation of the project. And this grant opportunity continues to be a key driver for the project in moving current initiatives forward so that they're eligible for that grant funding when round 3 comes around. Additionally, as Pavel mentioned, federal funding. The project has applied for and been successfully awarded $800,000 in planning grant fundings from the U.S. Department of Interior Bureau of Reclamation's Title 16 program. And so that's provided funding for additional planning efforts, final design, program management, and value engineering. And the city and the project will continue to be eligible to apply for additional Title 16 funding for implementation and eligible for up to 25% of implementation costs. And these two funding sources, being one state and one federal, could be both successfully obtained to really offset project costs to the community. There's another break in the action here. We have questions.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention this. One of the slides that was removed, it said the phase one on-site cost is estimated to be $16 to $25 monthly per household. That's the rate increase.
Yeah, so one of the things we did to try to...
It's right here.
No, it's not in my...
It's in mine.
It's not in my printout, but I have it on my screen.
I think it was in the original PowerPoint that was
provided
with the agenda package. And my understanding is that that took annual costs and then just calculated the number of homes in all the communities, so it wasn't a community-specific analysis, just kind of a general barometer of, you know, what's the household impact of this project.
Okay.
Okay.
So next steps. So there are a number of upcoming critical stakeholder agency decision points that will be coming back to this and other governing boards as this project moves forward. And so we just want to preview those for you today. These include development of final project benefit participation and cost-sharing agreements, as well as individual agency participation percentages in capital and O&M, development of a governance structure for the project, potential water or wastewater rate increases through Prop 218 hearings, and then additionally mechanisms to reconcile costs paid to date relative to the level of participation, really to true up the costs so that the costs that have been contributed by the different organizations are equivalent to the amount of benefit that they ultimately receive from the project. And then just quickly going over the latest project schedule. So just here's a high-level schedule kind of outlining a little bit where we've been and where we're headed. Again, so in 2018, with a lot of the focus was on groundwater modeling, the preliminary design, the technology piloting at the pilot plant, and, you know, looking to connect to the community through the demonstration facility and the ribbon cutting and a number of tours that Ben has hosted at the pilot plant, the wastewater plant. 2019 is focused on preliminary design, and we'll be transitioning to environmental review. That'll provide opportunity for public participation and comments. Additionally, some of the Proc 1 groundwater grant activities, as I described, are underway and will be worked on in 2019 and 2020. 2020, 2021, that will comprise the final design and permitting phase of the project with an anticipated kickoff date in 2022 and operations potentially initiating in 2024. And that concludes my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from anyone from the board?
Yeah, do you have any target dates for the draft EIR release?
I don't have target dates. I would say that the EIR consultant is working on it. One of the goals is to been to identify a viable offsite location, and so that can be included as part of that co-equal analysis. I would say a project description has been developed for, you know, at an admin level, but it's just still waiting on being finalized before it comes out. But ideally before the end of the year is when that comes, the project description and the notice of preparation should come out.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so any public comment on this item? Any questions?
Sure.
Come on up to the microphone, please.
Whoa. I'm Rebecca Ventrini, a Oceana resident. Can you tell me about Prop 218? Is that a county thing that will be voted on or statewide? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah, you should talk to...
Oh, hi. County or state? It's county, right?
Yeah, it would be...
You mean in terms of Prop 218 itself?
Who gets to vote on it, basically. Yeah.
So Prop 218 is a constitutional is a provision within our state constitution.
Okay.
So it applies to all local agencies. It does not apply to state agencies.
Okay.
But just local agencies. There's multiple ways that local agencies can develop revenues under Prop 218. The basic three are that if you do a tax election, it requires two-thirds voter approval. Assessments is a property owner vote, and property owners have to approve it with a 50% approval in proportion to the proposed assessments. So if an apartment building is going to get assessed more than a single-family home, then they get more votes. It's a dollar. Basically, it's $1 per vote. And assessments become liens on properties, and so that's why property owners get a vote. And then for water and sewer systems, raising service charges, you know, your normal monthly water sewer bill, the board has the authority to do that subject to a protest hearing. And basically it takes 50% of the community to protest it, and then the board's not allowed to do it. So, again, three different ways. Taxes, two-thirds voter approval. Assessments, 50% property owner approval in proportion to assessments. And then service charges, which is part of your normal bills, and that remains the discretion of the board.
Okay.
Subject to a protest hearing.
And then what would be your backup plan if it doesn't pass as far as just getting funding?
That's too soon to tell because the method of financing really hasn't been resolved yet and laid out.
Okay.
So, for example, when we rebuilt Lopez Dam, part of it was funded, about half of it. Voters approved a bond measure by more than two-thirds vote to pay for about half of it.
Okay.
The other half you end up incurring on your water bill. So you can even do a hybrid of these different types of measures, and those recommendations haven't been discussed. Haven't been finalized, as Dan had been mentioning. There's a lot of different options that we're talking about, but again, more to follow on those points.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Any other public comment?
Yeah, there's somebody.
Mostly about the Dave Leffler, a local resident here. Probably mostly about the model, and that is. It looks like there's kind of a limited amount of data because there's a limited, at least what I've seen here, and there may be a lot more. I'm curious about how the history match of the model matches with the reality of groundwater pumping and that type of thing. And sometimes these models are great. Sometimes they're not as calibrated as we'd like them to be. I'm just kind of curious, what's your feelings about that?
Well, so calibration is the key word there, and Dan, maybe you can speak to that.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, so the process of developing the model is actually also included a number of phases. There was initially a groundwater model that was developed for when the project was really considered just a Pismo Beach wastewater plant project only, and it just modeled injection of water from Pismo. As the project expanded into a regional project and incorporated the sand district in its flows, a new groundwater model was developed. And as Pablo described, calibration is critical in all those. And so both models were calibrated. Actually, two different hydrogeologic consultants worked on each different model, so the second consultant had the opportunity to vet the first model and incorporate components. And then additionally, as we went through the calibration process, you know, we gathered all the data we could for historic pumping and historic groundwater levels and areas of development and flow from Mora Grande Creek and all the inputs that go into a model. And then we vetted that through a technical advisory group that included, you know, four or five hydrogeologists, both representing the Northern Cities Management Area, as well as a number of hydrogeologists working in the Napomo Mesa Management Area. So, I guess, and then additionally, all modeling deliverables went through the Northern Cities Management Area Technical Group for their review and input. And so, the model was developed using the best available technology, the best available information, and with significant technical oversight. To try to calibrate to the best that it can. Yeah.
And I might have actually made a statement that caused a little bit of speculation as to the amount of data in that model because there is a lot of details in it, a lot of details associated with the different areas within the groundwater basin. The statement that I made during Dan's presentation is that there's still more that we can understand, but that's there's a difference between what the hydrogeologist calls a static model, which is how are we at where we're at and what's been going on, and I think that a lot of good information has been developed on that. It's the next steps associated with the what-ifs. So, for example, what if pumping on the Mesa increases? How is the model going to help us address what the influence is going to be on us. Or even if the Mesa hadn't been pumping so much over the last 10 years, would our basin be down here in better conditions? So in terms of the basis of the model, I think we all have a high degree of confidence in what's been developed. The future work is the what-if scenarios.
That's when they become fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, those kind of models. The reason I'm concerned is that I remember in Long Beach years ago, we had also subsidence with groundwater and oil production types of things, and that created an awful lot of problems on the surface even, not just water supply. And so I was curious if there was any data that shows us we're in good shape with this stuff. We don't want to run out of water, obviously. And so just curious about those kind of issues.
So, Dan, I think the overall conclusion of the analysis right now is that we are really very much concerned about the overall long-term reliability of the basin. I don't think we're seeing things like land subsidence, though. And our geology is just basically different than other areas.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, through the technical group, we haven't observed or discussed any issues related to subsidence. Really, the focus is on seawater intrusion, groundwater levels, keeping them as high as we can, and maintaining a reliable water supply.
Anything else? Any other public comment? Okay, well, thank you.
I did have one other question. I'm sure called, if I may. At the Central Coast Water Board meeting, you presented some results of aerial studies related to seawater intrusion, and the chair, I believe his name is Wolf, said that he did not believe that that methodology was very accurate, and he suggested an alternative study that might be done with some equipment that Cal Poly had, I believe. Has that been investigated at all?
And I'm trying to recall. I didn't recall him questioning the accuracy or maybe his own familiarity. But so the aerial geophysics work, that's going to be funded by the Prop 1 groundwater grant that we described earlier. That hasn't been initiated. One of the initial tasks will be developing a plan for collecting geophysical data. One of the things we've talked about, and we'll see if there's enough budget, is potentially doing both aerial as well as ground-based geophysics analysis. And that would be ideal. And so we're going to be evaluating that. The plan for geophysics will be evaluated by another technical advisory committee made up of regional board and division of drinking water representatives, as well as the funding agency. So there will be and scrutiny as well as it'll go through the NCMA technical group. So it's definitely will be under evaluation. And then I would just, one of the key reasons for the aerial geophysics in this for this project is that one of the unknowns we have, we've seen seawater intrusion onshore, but in very limited instances. It's not like a lot of basins that you would find potentially to the south in Ventura area, or not to point areas of geography out, but areas that have had significant seawater intrusion for a long time is well documented, or up in the Monterey region, where the seawater has intruded to the point where it's impacted multiple wells and gone miles inland, and you have better data on where that front of fresh water is located. Here, we would need more data, and we're going to collect that, and the way to collect that is through the aerial geophysics, because it allows you to fly offshore and fly over the ocean and using sensors detect where that seawater front or interface is under the ocean. And that'll help us better understand the pathways for seawater intrusion and better inform the design for the project.
Yeah, you might want to go back and take a look at his comments.
Yeah, no, I'll revisit those. Yeah.
I remember him saying it could be inaccurate if there were underground gas pipelines that were unused aerial phone lines, things like that. So
okay, yeah, I'll revisit that.
No, it was this study was also showing over land, predicting over land as well.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah,
do you want to take like a 3-4 minute break?
Yeah.
And then we can
Yeah.
Finish up this.
I would like a 3 or 4 minute break.
Okay. We'll take 5 minute break. Come back at 20 till. everybody here? Okay, so let's move on to our next item, which is our staff reports. So Office Operations Field Supervisor Tony Maricino.
Good evening, Board. Tony Maricino. So Lopez is currently at 56.7% full, which is 28,010 acre feet. We had zero SSOs for the month of July. State water is still at 10 acre feet. Lopez has delivered 188 acre feet, and we have pumped 131 acre feet. So we've had our daily rounds, our samples, eight work orders. We had 52 USAs, and that's due to the fact that the drainage project and the multiple contractors that are involved, also that PG&E has a contractor going around on Halcyon and Highway 1 that will be basically inspecting the poles, the wooden poles, and then treating them. So there's quite a few, each poles in the individual USA. That's why we have so many. We had 11 customer service calls. We had two after-hours call-outs. One was on York for a turn-on, and then the other one was on Highway 1 for no water. Apparently, the neighbors decided to shut off both homes and only turned theirs back on for some repairs. All right. We installed two brand-new services in the alleyway between Highway 1 and Beach for an empty lot that's going to be a future development for two homes. We're still installing meters, concrete, and boxes in the alleyway. So we had those three 12-inch valves on Paso that are part of the drainage project. Two of them have been completed, and we have paved back those locations. There was a few things we discovered, valves that weren't working properly, even though they operated. Little hiccups here and there. The third one's getting installed tomorrow. So that's all going very well. Door hangers for notifications. We ran into one incident that we didn't know a valve was shut. There was a few residents that got shut off, and it happened. So we'll get that valve repaired here in the near future also. A lot of coordination with the drainage project. Our sewer mains are going to be getting lowered on Railroad at the end of this week. We got some water mains getting relocated on Dolphin for the drainage coming up either Friday or Tuesday. So it's keeping in coordination and contact with everybody over there. But it's going well for us.
I was just going to say that I noticed that you marked stuff around Halcyon.
So, yes, you have the street of Halcyon with all the poles there, and the PG&E has a contractor going out there inspecting the wooden poles and inside Halcyon. I'm guarantee I've had my staff out there. I'm not aware of what exactly is going on out there, but they are.
I'm glad they are, because I'm not either.
Yes. most likely when the USA gets called in, we're just letting them know where our utilities are at. I don't know what projects are going on inside there, as long as there's not a conflict with our utilities. That's our biggest concern.
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you know what all that big piles of dirt, like asphalt, broken down asphalt, is over on Railroad by the ice company?
So, I don't know where it's coming from, but they have started laying it down in that area where UPS is at. They've had a backhoe over there pushing it around, laying it on that kind of dirt area where everything's at over there.
I just wondered what it was. It's huge.
It's grindings from probably
road grindings.
Yes, road grindings.
Yeah. Okay, I just wondered.
Yes.
Thanks. Anybody else have any questions for Tony?
Anybody? Thank you.
Five Cities Fire Authority, Chief Lieberman.
Good evening, Steve Lieberman, Fire Chief. I do not have a comprehensive report such as Tony. Very briefly, I just wanted to share with you that we're staying busy. We've had a couple of small, thankfully, knock on wood fires in the last few days. But most of my time has been focused on the public safety power shutdown planning that you'll be hearing about later this evening. So I'll save it for then. Thank you, unless you have any questions.
Nope.
Thanks.
President Austin, members of the board, pretty quick report from me as well, because after the last meeting, the next day, I headed up to the Pacific West, Northwest, and spent most of the following 2 weeks there. And I'd love to give you a detailed report with a PowerPoint on that, but I don't think that's quite in the cards tonight. Got back last Wednesday, and so, of course, worked with Carrie, Celia, and everybody in getting the agenda package. The two primary, and the generator contract is basically getting executed now, so we'll be getting the schedule for the installation of the generator soon from the contractor and then providing a notice to proceed. But the two primary areas focused on have been on the Pershing North Swing construction contract documents, and those will be on the next agenda, as well as the ballot language for the March 2020 special tax. And basically going through the due diligence efforts right now, reviewed numerous elections that have occurred by different agencies in 2018. Over the last couple of years, I think there was actually a special one in 2019 as well. We'll be following what goes on in Templeton. Theirs is a mail-in ballot, which is going to come to a conclusion, I think, August 27th or thereabouts. But part of that is reviewing what the other agencies have been doing for legal citations, findings, ballot language, and then checking out which ones have passed and which ones haven't passed to see if we can see anything unique about those that have passed and have been picking up some notes. And be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions? Okay. Well, thank you very much. We have no one here from the Sheriff's Office, so do we have any public comment on the staff reports? Okay, seeing none, we'll move on to Board of Director and Outside Committee reports. I think I'll start with Vice President White.
Okay, I joined our President and Shirley Gibson in at the meeting in Templeton of the special San Luis Obispo County Special Districts Association, and some people from the County Planning Department gave us a report on changes that are coming up in the planning area standards, specifically about small homes and secondary dwellings. And they're in the middle of working on projects and that, and they're also working on the whole issue of housing needs, and it's kind of scary the amount of extra houses they're saying that we're going to have to put into our communities in the next 20 years, which I thought was kind of interesting, like 10,800 more houses in the county by 2028. And they also, Dave Church from LAFCO, Local Area Formation Commission, gave a report on sphere of influence. They're right now working on various sphere of influence, but part of Oceano is going to be in a new sphere of influence study coming up within the next year. And other than that, it was kind of, there was a lot of information that kind of went over my head, and I think, you know, I'm hoping when they get it all figured out, because they were talking about increasing the density in areas that have community services and not increasing the reducing the density of housing in rural areas. Like, you have to have more than 2 acres to put a house with a septic tank in a rural area, but when there's sewer service, you can get an amazing amount of size houses on a lot. So, but it's all in the works. Anyway, that's my very rough report.
Yeah. The sphere of influence, what was that? I don't remember what that was about.
Well, they're just talking about new boundaries for sphere of influence. I'll be studying them. Pablo probably already knows that.
So the Local Agency Formation Commission, part of their charter is to evaluate local agencies and spheres of influence and boundaries. Mm-hmm. I think that they're supposed to look at each agency around every 5 years. Pretty hard schedule to keep up on. But in any case, included in the Oceano, LAFCO addresses Arroyo Grande, Grover, and Oceano together. And so many years ago, LAFCO had considered the question of should Oceano be within the sphere of influence of Grover? If you're in the sphere of influence, then that means that LAFCO is anticipating that that land will be annexed to the city in the future. So when that question came up several years ago, LAFCO said no, and Oceano was not included in the sphere of influence of Grover. Similarly, right now, Morro Bay basically has a zero sphere of influence, or it's coterminous with their boundaries, which means that LAFCO doesn't support annexations to the city of Morro Bay. The idea, though, of sphere of influence is that they're looking at what are the services that are being provided and, you know, can the what should be the growth of the cities. Sphere of influence has less to do, then, with unincorporated areas like Oceano. Instead, they'll be focusing on our service levels. And in the most recent, you know, several years ago, sphere of influence, it spoke to, for example, the fact that Five Cities Fire Authority provides services to all three communities. So it looks a lot about the what do they anticipate the growth over time and annexations to cities, but it also looks at service levels and how agencies are working together to meet needs of communities.
Thank you.
Do you know if the presentations are available for those of us who weren't able to attend? Did they make that available?
Did they do PowerPoints? I wasn't able to attend.
No.
Yes.
No.
They had PowerPoint. It wasn't. I didn't think it was very clear.
I think it was Carolyn Berg and Trevor Keith.
Yes.
So I can reach out to them. And
yes. Thank you. That would be helpful.
Okay. Director Villa, do you have anything? No. Director Gibson?
Nothing else.
Director Rapolo?
No.
Okay.
Well, I had one thing I was just going to add. We were in Templeton, and, you know, they're having that special election for fire funding, and they had some wonderful posters and banners and promotional things that we took note of as we drove away. Thank you. But, of course, we don't have any funding to... I mean, it would have to be independent funding to do that. I know that.
Yeah, I'm going to be up in Templeton tomorrow morning meeting with some of their staff because, you know, obviously, those I've seen the banners in Templeton and stuff. I am, like, 99.9% confident that they know that they didn't pay for those out of CSD funds.
Oh, no.
But I don't know who the local group is that's sponsoring up in Templeton. So I'll inquire a little bit about the community organizational efforts that are going on.
Thank you. Yeah, big red banners with fire hats on them across the whole street. It was wonderful. Anyway, I see one on the depot.
We got a post for that, so we'll make sure we get one.
Thank you.
Okay, so I attended the South County Sanitation District meeting. And, you know, at our previous meeting, it was... Well, this last meeting was August 7th, last week, last Wednesday. But at our previous meeting 2 weeks prior, we had agreed to go with a contract for the PLA, the Project Labor Agreement with the unions, with taking the construction management agreement out of the project. And it was to come back, it was to go to the unions, and they were to come back with a signature on it to agree to the contract by close of business on the last Wednesday, August 7th, when we had our meeting. And so during that whole 2 weeks, there was no communication whatsoever with the trade unions, and our general manager reached out with emails and phone calls trying to see where they were, and they did not respond at all. So it was on our agenda to decide, you know, what we were going to do. And so as we got to discussing it, my stand was that they did not respond, that we needed to just cancel the PLA and go on with our bid process with all the trades in the county. And then my two other board members thought it would be in the best interest to allow 7 more days of time for them to respond. That our chair received a call right prior to the meeting that said maybe they could use some more time. So they agreed to give them more time, and I was definitely not for that. We received a letter from the non-trade unions that we are under a big threat of litigation because of, it's called discrimination against fair and open competition by just having a labor union handle the contracts and not opening up to all contractors. So it was a vote of 2-1 to give them 7 more days to respond, and I was quite disappointed because it's very obvious it's not in the best interest of the sanitation district to do this. It's already cost the district. We've spent $9,300 in engineering services, $17,500 in legal services, and $12,000 in district staff time. So it's cost $38,800 to get to this point, and then they didn't have the decency or respect to respond in the time they were given a deadline, and then they were given more time. So I don't believe it's being a good steward of our ratepayers' money to do that, and I was very vocal in objecting to the extension, because it doesn't do anything for the district at all. It only does something for the one small group. My other board members argue that it is, yes, it will cost us more up front, but however, there will be such a great benefit as the money will stay in the local and spent in our communities, will prosper mm-hmm. from the money spent in the communities, which it would be the same thing if we had everyone else bidding, because the other companies are local also, is the way I see it. And then I'm thinking we're stewards of taxpayers' money, and I don't think it's our job to speculate on, well, let's do a project and spend more money on it that we don't really have to spend, with the think that maybe it'll help the whole community. I just don't think it works that way. So today was their deadline in 7 days, and they responded, and they did sign it. So that's where we're at right now, that looks like it will go through. However, there's a big question on the USDA loan that we were getting, and the sanitation district would apply for the USDA loan because of Oceano and our disadvantaged status, that we could bring, this community could bring $4.8 million to the project. And it's up in the air because most of the government agencies do not, they want open and fair competition, not just one unit. So the USDA, they will not tell you right off, like, no, we won't fund you. And there is a part in the contract that says if they don't, then the contract would be dead. So, but we don't know how long it's going to be. So in the meantime, we're going to be spending a lot of unnecessary money to keep it going. And every delay, it's $55,000 a month, the more it's delayed. So so that's where we're at. We're at that where they did sign it. We do have a PLA. And now we'll just be waiting to see if we're going to be able to get government funding. And the other construction companies are filing cases with all the federal government agencies that we'd be getting money from to let them know that they're calling it discrimination. So that's my sad report for the sanitation district, sorry to say.
What happens if they don't get the government funding?
Well, we don't get the, if we don't get the 4.8, they thought, well, we'll get it somewhere else, but we probably won't. It'll just cost more. I don't know if you would have a quick answer.
My understanding was that if USDA comes back with an affirmative statement that the PLA agreement will invalidate the USDA loan, then didn't the sanitation district board
vote that the PLA was contingent on being able to qualify? So if USDA comes back and says no go, then the PLA agreement is dead. Yeah.
Yeah. So we won't know that for a while. In the meantime, we're having a lot of threats of litigation against us, which will cost, lawyer fees. It's just unnecessary bureaucracy that's been thrown upon us at the last minute that we didn't need at this time in this project in our community. So, anyway, we'll just wait to see what happens now. And that's my end of my report. Are there any questions on the reports? Okay.
Do you have any?
Where's my agenda? I lost it. Okay, then we'll move on now to the consent agenda. The minutes of July 24th and the review and approval of the cash disbursements. So has everyone had a chance? And we do have the revision on the cash disbursements, correct? Mm-hmm. Any discussion on these yet?
Any make a motion.
Well, maybe public.
Oh, public comment.
Have public comment. Is there any public comment on the minutes or the cash disbursements? Okay, seeing none, then we'll come back to the board on this.
I make a motion that we approve the consent agenda as amended.
Second. Okay, moved and seconded. Can we get a roll call, please?
Vice President White?
Yes.
Director Villa?
Yes.
Director Gibson?
Yes.
Director Opogo?
Yes.
President Austin?
Yes. Okay. Business items, 9A. Update on the emergency actions approved on July 10th, authorizing the general manager to procure the necessary equipment, services, and supplies needed to resume groundwater pumping. By a 4/5 vote, determine that there is a need to continue with the emergency actions.
President Austin, members of the board, I don't have really any substantive additional verbal comments to make. As the staff report indicated, we have been able to resume or get, eight back motor back installed. However, we're concerned about the actual power feeds, and so those are going to be monitored before we have confidence that we can operate it on a continuous basis, because in the last 7 months or so we've had two engines burn, and there could be a problem with the power feed. The other thing I just sort of wanted to make an anecdotal comment on is that the resolution that your board adopted authorizing emergency actions under the public contracts code, part of that is to be able to make sure we could go out and expeditiously apply equipment and line up contractors without having to go through all the details of the public contracts code. Well, as it turns out, our total project costs are under $60,000, and the public contracts code essentially allows the district, full discretion on how we would implement anyhow. So it's really through an abundance of caution that we've been adopting the resolutions and declaring the emergency, but it really hasn't given us any more latitude just because the dollar amounts that are actually being spent are relatively small. They're under, again, the $60,000 under the public contracts code, which would allow us to procure services and equipment, however the district felt was appropriate. So we do recommend approval of the action to continue the emergency, and the staff report had identified some of the upcoming work that we still have going on. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Are there any questions?
Yeah. First of all, thank you for sending me the well diagram. If anybody wants to look at this, I can pass it down. Helps me to understand how the well works and what it looks like. When are you expecting that the casing will be scrubbed to see if that's still usable or not?
So I was waiting on a third estimate regarding the scrubbing and rebuilding construction of that well. So as soon as I get the third one, and then we can go from there.
So pretty soon?
Yes.
Thank you.
I had a question. You said Well 8 is back online, but what's the deal? Are you monitoring the electrical?
Yeah, so the motor has been reinstalled. It's not back online in terms of on a continuous basis because PG&E came out and maybe you can explain that better, Tony.
So Well 8 is reinstalled. The first few times we've turned it on, it's actually tripped the breaker on PG&E's side, not ours, and it's raising a concern for me, especially two motors that have gone down. They put a recorder on there. I'm also looking at looking at what a recorder will take for us to install, not with PG&E involved, and then we can take a look at it that way, possibility, so we can send them the data. Yes. So right now, I don't have faith in the power supply.
Is there a way to put another fuse link in it so it can kick off and not burn up?
It's not on our behalf. We have breakers.
Yeah.
But it's the PG&E is the one that's tripping.
So, you know, as Tony indicated, the recorder is going to hopefully help diagnose the situation a little bit better. It's really kind of speculative right now to indicate what the cause is. I will say, though, that we've seen this happening in other situations. Up at the Lopez Water Treatment Plant several years ago, there was anomalies on everything getting tripped and everything. And one of the things that I know is influencing it in some situations is the degree to which solar is coming online. Because in some ways, solar is a little bit dirty power. It doesn't, the sine waves or the megahertz or whatever it is, when we get normal power feeds, it's on a really clean sine wave. And when solar happens, you get a little bit of a dirtier sine wave or a dirtier wave that on bigger powered equipment can cause them to trip. There's solutions to that, including better transformers and other types of things, but they're generally pretty costly. So I do know that sometimes these types of situations are being caused because of increased solar on the network or on the local grid, and there's reason to believe that that's happened in some situations, but again, it would be way too speculative to be able to draw that conclusion in this situation. And the recorder hopefully will help identify what's going on with the power feed. But what to do about it would be then another question.
Is that 220 or 440 or what?
480.
480, yes.
Yes.
Yeah. That's what I thought. Yeah.
So if we're getting dirty power from PG&E, is that something they need to fix or would we have to fix it ourselves?
Oh, I think we would assert that they need to fix it. That's right.
We just need the data to show that. Different times of the day, different days of the week.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Tony.
We ready for a motion?
Public comment? Public comment on item 9A. Any public comment? Okay, seeing none. Are we ready for a motion?
I make a motion that we authorize the general manager. I make a motion that we declare the emergency continues and authorize the general manager to procure necessary equipment, services, and supplies needed to resume groundwater pumping. And yes.
Second.
Is there a prop?
To continue, it's required by a 4/5 vote.
Say it's required.
You don't have to do it. It's just I'm just reinforcing the requirement. Is
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's been moved and seconded. Then we need a roll call vote, please.
Vice President White?
Yes.
Director Pogue?
Yes.
Director Gibson?
Yes.
Director Villa?
Yes.
President?
Yes. Okay. All right. 9B, consideration of adopting a social media policy.
President Austin, members of the board, the social media policy has been
We have some edits, which I like. Director Ropogal provided those. Essentially that, recommending approval of staff recommendations as modified.
Question, are these enough changes that we need to put it over 2 weeks, or can we still act?
No. When you're making changes to ordinances, because of the way ordinances are introduced at one meeting and then subject to a subsequent one, if you have substantive changes to ordinances, then you have to renotice the ordinances. But on policies, anybody who's interested in the policy is free to come to the meeting and review changes. You can make changes on the fly. You're okay. Good to adopt.
Okay, thank you.
I had a couple questions. On number 6, so it talks about any district employee or board member discovers negative comments about the district on the district or other social media sites should notify the general manager. So are you talking about like personal Facebook pages? Is that what you mean by other social media sites?
The statement is pretty broad in terms of what you might discover, and we're really focused in there about negative comments, I guess, that require correct misinformation. And so the issue of correcting misinformation is really to correct data that's wrong. If it says something that's absolutely incorrect, it's not the idea of negative opinions about the district, again, factual information that's incorrect, and especially that which is negative about the district. But misinformation is, we might suggest who discovers negative factual comments about the district. Inserting factual into there might be a good clarifier on that.
Or non-factual?
Yeah. We discover...
So, are you saying, like, if you see something that's totally not wrong, true on another site, then you would post it on our site that...
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying, that there was a post here that we want to clarify that was not true?
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
And then in the same vein, on page 3, paragraph 2, it talks about subject to California public records laws if requested. And so this may include information about you that you made available through your social media privacy settings. So again, is that something like somebody's Facebook post on their personal site?
No. So that's when individuals are free to submit questions and comments to the district underneath our normal website.
Oh, okay.
And then if we turn around and say, hey, this is a really good question or comment, and we are then going to post it on the website in order to, part of our public outreach, we're basically telling people up front that they post something with us. Once they post with us, it's public information.
Okay, so it's when they post on our website.
Right.
Okay. That clears that up.
Any other questions or comments on the social media? Any public comment on the social media policy?
I knew that we had said that we weren't going to have any comments,
That's right. Individuals can't post to our social media sites. They can send us questions and comments to our website, and then we have the discretion on whether or not we're going to take some of those questions and post them on our social media site.
But if they go on the Facebook, there won't be an area there where you can contact or...
There'll be information so that they'll have links where to send us emails, and there's going to be contact information on there.
but it's not going to be a blog site where they can post comments
directly. Let's say there's an event this weekend.
But they'll be able to just comment and send it.
To us.
Yeah. On the Facebook page.
What it does is it provides a link.
Oh, only a link.
To, so they can send us an email, yeah.
So there's no comments then, like if you say we're going to...
Yeah, there's no blog site.
Barbecue, and you forget to put the time. You can't write what time is this.
Well, they can send us an email and say, "Hey, you didn't indicate the time,"
good.
And so we can.
Mm-hmm.
So on this item six, maybe the insertion here: any district employee or board member who discovers negative, factually incorrect comments. Mm-hmm. Does that work?
Yeah, I think that sounds better. Good.
Okay.
Well, just facts, it doesn't need to be negative or positive if it's incorrect. It needs to be corrected.
You have a problem with positive, incorrect comments?
Well.
What, they give us credit when it's rotten or early due?
Yeah, yeah.
We don't want any positive.
Well, I think you still have the discretion to do that.
Yeah.
The focus here is... We really want to be able to clarify factually incorrect comments that get out there.
I think it tells us about everything.
Okay, so then I will, in addition to the edits that are shown in the document, my recommendation is further modified to include factually incorrect in item six. So if it,
I have one more question. In next door, it's designed to make comments to stuff. How do you not?
Yeah. Nicole has been doing the research on that, and she indicates that both Facebook and Nextdoor, you have the ability again to post comments for outreach, but limits the ability for individuals to. Use it as a blog site.
Okay.
Is there any, I didn't notice, is there any, can you share posts? Like OCSD post, can you share it to?
Oh, so like if you pull up the app and we have a post and you want to share it to others, I would assume that you can do that, yeah.
Yeah, so...
A cleanup thing or something, you want to make sure everybody gets it, you can share it to others.
Yeah.
Put it on your Facebook or something.
Yeah. So on Nextdoor, it's really easy to disable commenting. When you first post, you just check a box or something. On Facebook, it's more complicated. You actually have to go in and set it to filter out any comments that include, like, 100 common words. There's no setting for it, but it does work. But all the other features, like sharing, will still function. It'll just... disable commenting.
So on Nextdoor, if someone wanted to say what's wrong with my water, can they post that, or do they have to go to the website?
They have to go to the website.
Okay.
But then we know there's a water cup or something, then you have a post.
That's right. So that's the idea is that if we have a water line break and we know we're going to see dirty water, we post it real quick so that people can see it.
So I won't have to do it.
Yeah.
I did it. Okay.
So on this one, I would recommend if you please your board to approve staff recommendations as modified in order to avoid having to go through all the details of
everything. Does anyone want to make a motion then? We did. There's no public
copy. Do you want to make a motion?
I move that we adopt the social media policy with staff recommendations as modified. Did I say that correctly?
Yeah.
Second. Okay, moved and seconded. Can we get a roll call, please?
Director Pogel?
Yes.
Director Villa?
Yes.
Director Gibson?
Yes.
Vice President White?
Yes.
President Austin?
Yes. Okay, good. All right. 9C, discussion of the public safety power shutoff measures established by PG&E. Mr. Ogren, you have a...
Yes, President Austin, members of the board, a couple of items. One is I want to sort of recognize Chief Lieberman for the work that he's been doing already in coordination with other agencies with respect to the draft multi-day power outage contingency plan. I wasn't really planning on presenting it in details. If Chief Lieberman wants to hit a couple of highlights, then that's certainly welcomed. But it's still work in progress, and I just sort of wanted to include it to recognize that work that's been done, but it's not at the point where it's going to, you know, ready for a final draft for board comments or potential adoption. You know, the big picture issue is that PG&E has indicated to agencies throughout California that they might shut off the power, and basically they're telling us to prepare for power shutoffs that could be 5 or 7 days in duration in response to fires that have, they're under litigation on fires and causes of fires, and so this is part of their response. It's a little bit hard to imagine what responses they're going to have if they actually shut off power for a community for 5 to 7 days, because those are going to have significant impacts on many, many different areas. I think that the response on an extended timeline or power shutoff is, you know, the public response is going to be pretty significant. But it still sort of emphasizes to us that there is a new world in terms of preparing for emergencies. And for Oceano specifically, we don't have power backups for our wells. We've talked about it a number of occasions. We evaluated backup power for well 8 in coordination with the generator unit that we're putting in for the fire station and the sheriff substation. And that cost-benefit analysis, you know, clearly showed that the approach with the stations was the most cost-effective. And because we focused in on fire and sheriff substations through, again, help with Chief Lieberman as well as Sheriff Ian Parkinson, we were able to get the grant in order to pay for the generator unit itself. So it's been a good success in being able to get grant money for that and moving forward. And in prior discussions, even though they were a couple years ago, we knew that we would have to be addressing this issue about portable generator units for the wells themselves. I should clarify that in the recommendation number 2, direct staff to initiate efforts to purchase, that's basically doing the research. It all has to come back to your board prior to us being able to do anything. But again, got some feedback from Director Oplogle that I liked, which is with respect to the idea of, well, what about utilizing solar and battery backup to help meet this need? When we evaluated the generators for the stations, we found out that the batteries were infeasible because of costs of the batteries and how many batteries you would have to have. But I still like the idea of evaluating solar as well, because it's been the thought that a solar in the parking lot, and REC Solar focuses on these types of evaluations as some of the other ones do, but in an extended period here, it's really going to be in a situation where we have a lot of sun because there's a fire threat that's out there, unless the smoke from a fire has an effect. But it's not the situation where we would be, you know, with the stations, the need to have backup power really could be in the middle of a storm season and other types of situations. So, but on the extended duration that we're talking about with the PSP, you know, the idea is the power would be available for the sun. It would almost be like a hybrid type of a model. So I would like to also include that in the evaluation. They're separate in a way, but they can be interrelated as well. And in some ways, it might say, hey, if we put solar power in the parking lot, is that going to pay for itself just in and of itself and then be an additional benefit if we have a PSP event? But moving forward and evaluating the portable generator options and how we might be able to finance it, I think is critical. We had already intended on doing so. The PSP approach with PG&E just kind of puts it more on the front burner. And I do think that augmenting it with an evaluation of whether solar makes sense also makes is a good idea. And we've known that we've seen a lot of local Rio Grande High School put them in their parking lot a number of the high schools can. And so I think looking at the feasibility of that as well would be a good idea. And with that, I'd be glad to take any questions. Or if you want Mr. Lieberman to do a quick overview of his work, since he's here.
I have a question. Just if there's a fire, would this just be for fires in our area? Or if there's, say, a fire in Northern California, we would be affected? They would shut off our power? Come on up. He knows the answer.
I think the answer is it depends. But
good evening, Steve Lieberman. I guess I can start by answering that question. So just want to make sure everyone's aware that the power that's generated at Diablo Canyon Power Plant does not serve and provide energy to our county. It leaves our county and goes into the Central Valley. So the energy that's fed into San Luis Obispo comes from the Central Valley along two pretty critical transmission lines. Both those lines meet in Morro Bay at a big switching station, and from there it's distributed throughout the county. You may remember a few years ago we had a pretty substantial power failure in part of the county, and that was because of an issue at that Morro Bay switching center. So PG&E is using a handful of variables to determine if there's a safety issue where they need to consider shutting down a section of their infrastructure for fire threat. A couple of those include low relative humidity, high sustained winds with gusts up to an identified gust mile per hour, and I'm sure I don't know that off the top of my head, especially now. A red flag warning, which is going to be high temperatures along with a wind event, and a couple of other variables along with a final human decision. When you start putting that together, and that's what all the fire chiefs in the county are looking at, it's likely not going to be in a populated area in San Luis Obispo County. It's going to be those transmission lines that are traveling into the county that pass through probably a rural, unpopulated area that meets the criteria of being really hot, really windy, low relative humidity, and a red flag warning. So what the county is preparing for and why they're assuming a seven-day planning window is if the decision's made to impact our power supply, it could be very significant to the county. And that's what we're planning for. It won't be when we have a wind event and a eucalyptus tree takes out some power lines and we say we've lost power to this portion of a community. It's going to be big. So I want to make sure the community is aware of that without creating fear, but that's the reality of this. Stop me whenever you're ready. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. So if I could back up for a minute to share a little bit of information. I'd like to poll. Who's got an emergency kit at home? Some of you are in trouble.
Partially.
So this is a great reminder for us all to be personally prepared. And we always say be prepared for 3 days. Longer is better. And I've been talking to Vice President White quite a bit about that with her neighbors and her community. Food, water. Water's a gallon a day per person. Don't forget about your pets. Pet food. Cash, because if we lose power, we're going to lose access to our ATMs and banks. Gasoline, unlike the hurricane belt of the United States, most of our gas stations do not have backup generators to run the pumps. So this is a great reminder to keep your fuel tank at half or higher starting today or tomorrow. It's really the general preparedness information, and we've been working a lot with that, and there's a lot of information available on our website under emergency preparedness. If you go to our homepage, we've got a PSPS, Public Safety Power Shutoff link. Learn more. It takes you to the planning section. But I must say I'm really focusing on what I'll call the vulnerable population, and I'm working with the county long-term care ombudsman for our senior residential care facilities. I'm working with the county health department and the EMS division about how we're going to take care of people that are on home medical equipment, but trying to get the word out to folks that are home, in their homes with an oxygen concentrator or a suction machine or a portable dialysis machine or a left ventricle cardiac machine. Those are the folks that I'm concerned about. They should have plans for backup power. The best plan, should this come, is PG&E hopes to give us all 48 hours notice. So the best part of your plan is plan to leave once the word comes out, if you have somewhere out of our area to go visit some friends or family, that would be the best thing for you to do. Be somewhere with power, and you know you're going to have water, you know you're going to have sewer, and it's less, selfishly, it's a less of a resource strain on public safety. So we will be very busy, and I know in the planning discussions, as you start to imagine the reliance we're going to have on backup power and generators, is fuel will become king. We have one fuel distributor in the county of San Luis Obispo, and that's who we all rely upon. So now in part of the planning discussions, we're reaching into other counties to provide us fuel to keep those generators going, to continue to provide water and sewer service and emergency lighting. There was a question about solar, and I have seen solar generators. Typically, they will provide emergency lighting. So you park the solar generator, it will collect its power during the day and provide very bright LED lighting in the evening hours for safety. I'll stop there and see if there's any questions or if anything Mr. Ogren wants to add.
I had one concern in that television advertising is already marketing generators, and I was wondering if you will be doing an educational thing, because nothing can be more dangerous than a generator hooked into a house.
Thank you, and excuse me for that. With one of our staff home with a new baby, I've picked up more responsibility for our social media and public education campaigns, and I've loaded a lot of information about generator use at home. Obviously, we want those generators to stay outside of the house in a well-ventilated area. We don't want them on the deck near the sliding glass window to the house. We certainly don't want them in the house, and we want people to know how to safely use them and refuel them. So,
not plug them into their circuitry.
Yes, unless they have an electrical contractor taking care of that. A lot of moving parts.
So, yeah, I'm real familiar with regular generators, but they do have, like, solar generators out there now that you can get?
I've seen them. The ones I've seen have been at major incidents or major training events, and they're trailer-based because they have to carry a lot of batteries with them.
You can't just get one for home and charge
right.
it up during... It'd be a lot easier than
you could. They sell them for camping, for backpacking, what have you, and you just lay it out, and it'll charge smaller devices for you, laptop. Cell phones, things like that.
It won't have any connections.
What about having PG&E come and make a presentation?
Your board?
To our board.
Have they been doing that? I think they have.
They did a webathon today, an educational webathon today.
They had one at Arroyo Grande City Council.
They did?
Yeah.
So I don't know if Eric Daniels with PG&E Government Affairs has been before this board before, but he has done a number of presentations about what their plans are, why that this should be temporary, and that they have a hardening initiative to make their infrastructure safer. But he's definitely been making the rounds.
So this is like really the August, September, October, but then after that, will it be less, after it rains, will it be less likely?
So we believe, with our county and the way our winds pick up in September and October, we believe that's going to be the key window in terms of red flag warnings and the right wind patterns from a fire chief perspective. That's what we're thinking.
So
could be the key period of time.
The next few months,
yeah. So we need to hurry up and get our planning in order and be prepared.
Is that when we generally will get more Santa Ana winds then?
Yeah, we don't get the Santa Anas like others. I'm sorry. It's been a long day. There's a different wind pattern that has a name that impacts that eastern corridor into the county.
Santa Lucia winds?
You might be onto something there. That might be it.
Anyone else have any questions or anything?
So it sounds like a real downer discussion. So it's a great, here's the exciting part. It's a great opportunity to have a plan with your friends and family. It's a great idea to be prepared for any disaster by getting that kit put together at home. It's a great idea by doing it together as a family so you can learn and talk and have some fun and have dialogue while you're doing it together. And it's a great opportunity to spend money until your wife tells you to stop, because I've been augmenting our kit with additional lighting for our home, and she caught on to me.
So you have lots of batteries.
Lots of batteries, too. No candles, please.
No, we're done with the candles. We don't need candles.
My neighbor's got three antique kerosene lanterns she was showing me today.
Great.
I mean, seriously. She lives in a wood house, and one of them came from her grandmother.
You don't recommend kerosene.
If there's nothing else, thank you.
So, to clarify staff recommendation, obviously one is just to discuss, but it's two. And so the modified recommendation would be to direct staff to initiate efforts to purchase a backup generator, including potential use of solar power for the district's groundwater wells.
Is this a motion or just...
I so move. But we haven't had public comment yet.
I had a couple questions for... The solar panels, is there a reason why putting them over the parking lot would be preferred versus putting them on the buildings?
We can certainly look at both. I was just always thinking the parking lot because that's usually what we see with the schools. What I've generally heard is that for the installation, it's easier and it's less expensive to do it in parking lots. They don't have to worry about structural loads on buildings and whether the buildings can handle it or not versus doing it in the parking lot. You know, it's just basically some point loads that are easy to...
And if I could just interrupt, I'm sorry, but it's really important to know. I have solar panels on the roof of my personal residence. For the most part, for the vast majority of us, those panels will do nothing for us during the public safety power shutdown unless you've invested in backup batteries, which are very expensive, but many people are doing. So just by simply having solar panels, they won't power the building in an emergency unless you've engineered it and equipped it to do so.
Yeah, and my basic thought, though, that's got to be subject to more evaluation, is when we're operating the water wells, the biggest need of a generator is the startup of the well. That's when it's got a big, and same thing with air conditioners. It's when they start up, they have a big power draw. So the question is, can it operate like a hybrid where we know that we should have plenty of sunlight because we're in, you know, a fire threat. It's not like it's going to be a stormy winter day. And we do have the ability to operate the wells during the day. Often, we'll operate them at night because that's when off-peak power was available. That itself is changing, causing Tony then to reevaluate when he wants to operate the wells. But the thought is that if the solar makes sense on its own, then how might it also be able to supplement power during a PSP in order to reduce the fuel load that we have to have, because the idea is fuel is going to be one of those things that everybody is like, well, how are we going to have enough fuel? So if it can if solar makes sense on itself and it can provide some power, reducing our fuel demand during a PSP, then there might make sense there, and that's my analogy to sort of like the hybrid cars.
Yeah, I've in your same situation. I've got solar panels and no way to disconnect them from the grid, so I can't use them if PG&E power goes down, and they're not designed to have batteries either, so kind of useless if there's an outage. But my other question was the state is allowing PG&E to shift these impacts onto other agencies like ours. Is the state stepping up with any funding for disadvantaged communities to mitigate the additional costs that we have to spend to address them?
Not that I'm aware of.
So that's a great question, actually, because it was the one thing I forgot to share with you. Typically, in a declared disaster, declarations are made at the city or county level, and oftentimes there's federal funds for partial reimbursement or complete reimbursement for the impact to local government. This is not one of those. So in a way, this is like you said, we're shifting responsibility to local government, but there will be no additional funding source. So part of the planning process is for policymakers to realize that if there's a need to make expenditures during this period of time, it would be a general fund budget issue. I'm trying to end on a positive note.
In our case, a water fund, right? Because it's primarily to keep water going, flowing. The reimbursements in natural disasters, this wouldn't be considered a natural disaster. I think that, you know, providing the adequate emergency power backup is important for Oceano, regardless of the PSP, PSPS. It's just pushing it more to the front burner. So it's something that we should be doing anyhow. Ultimately, I'm still really interested in watching what the public reaction is going to be, PG&E's reaction to public reaction, and what the governor is going to say when and there is a seven-day shutoff, because the consequences of that are going to be so severe that I think we're going to see a lot of public dialogue when they have one. So it's really hard to see how this is going to play out. There's been discussion that PG&E is doing this in response to, you know, the risks that they're in the litigation filed against them because of the fires. So it's almost like it's a little bit of hardball that's going on. Understanding how that's all going to unravel is really kind of, wish I had a good crystal ball like that. But again, I think it's a good thing that the district needs to be doing. We had been talking about it before. We just need to move it to the front burner.
But you won't have to pay any PG&E bill.
Okay, so we have a... and there's no more comments, so we do have a motion. Do we have a second?
I made the motion.
Yeah, we had public comment, right? I don't think anybody... So we have a motion.
I so move.
Okay, we need a second.
Second.
Okay, roll call.
Vice President White?
Yes.
Director Polton?
Yes.
Director Gibson?
Yes.
Director Villa?
Yes.
President Alston?
Yes. All righty. 9D, review of the draft, the frequently asked questions relating to the fire tax.
And President Alston, members of the board, I was, you know, this because of the term frequently asked questions, and yet maybe that's a little bit of a misnomer because we're not getting a lot of questions from the public yet. These questions really were, Carrie was taking notes over the numerous workshops or meetings that we've been having over the last several months. So she put the questions together, and then I worked with her in kind of categorizing them, and then, you know, I did some final edits on them. Chief Lieberman sent me a couple of additional questions, one which I really like, which is, why do the emergency responders take the fire engine, not fire truck?
To lunch or to food?
No.
Fire.
Fire
engine.
Why do they respond both in the ambulance and the fire?
And, yeah. To medical events. And, you know, the idea is because they have to be ready for secondary calls. We were doing something at the local realtor group, and they asked the question of why do the responders take the fire engines to the grocery store? And the answer, and apparently there's actually been some sort of nasty interactions where people have been a little bit rude to them in the grocery store. But again, if they're in the middle of the grocery store and they buy their own food, you know, they have to be ready to drop what they're doing, get in that engine, and respond to a call.
Yeah, they can't run back from the store, get in there.
So I'm meeting with Chief tomorrow. What time is that?
Thursday. Tomorrow's Thursday.
Afternoon,
yeah, because I'm in Templeton in the morning. Good. I was afraid a little bit there that I messed up my calendar. The questions in front of you today, I wasn't going to go through them one by one or anything else like that, simply giving your board the opportunity to provide feedback, if it, you know, provides any suggestions on other questions that you might have. It seems to me that we have a lot of questions, and, you know, we'll have to look at, you know, seeing about paring them down. But again, I wanted to get them organized and in front of your board. Thank Carrie for her note-taking during prior board meetings, and then open it up to board discussion at this time.
On the very last question, passage or failure of the special tax affect the cost of fire insurance. You're talking about personal fire insurance, correct?
The fire rating.
because of the fire rating.
Is that what that means?
Under financial questions, the last question.
That's correct. Yeah. How might this affect your own homeowner insurance policy?
Yeah.
Yes.
Maybe that would be clearer for people.
Okay.
I think you did a very good job compiling this list, because I see questions that we asked at different meetings.
Yeah. I think it's covering everything. Do you say you want to get less questions?
Well, there are a lot of questions, and we can, you know, address them all. I should mention, too, that on July 10th, your board directed President Austin and I to send a letter to the Board of Supervisors asking the question of essentially initiating consultation on potential divestiture. Would they expect the fire station? Would they expect the sheriff's substation? Would they expect any other district-owned assets? And so we have forwarded that. I forwarded a letter to County Administrative Officer Wade Horton and then his assistant, Lisa Howe, who's been working on this, to give them the opportunity to review it first, and whether they forward it to the Board of Supervisors or ask me to do it directly. I did it yesterday, so I haven't heard back from them yet, but we have followed up and submitted that to the county. But in terms of, you know, the volume of questions, we have a lot. One way of managing a lot of questions like this is simply to keep them in these types of categories and to develop the public information around the different categories.
Well, I think it's excellent to have them and break down the categories.
Some of the questions I'm going to have to work with Chief Lieberman in responding.
Mm-hmm.
Some, as I mentioned, we've already sent a letter to the county.
Everyone's important.
And some, you know, need to reach out to Cal Fire Chief Scotty Gelbert in mm-hmm. order to ask for his assistance in providing some of them. And as I mentioned, I'm going to be up in Templeton tomorrow, so I'll be able to ask them some of the questions regarding Templeton specifically.
So one question I didn't see here that a couple of residents have asked me is, why don't we just have more paramedics and ambulances, and why do we have all these fire trucks when it's mostly medical issues and not fire issues? So that would be a good one to include. Also think it would be good if somewhere here you could link to those response time maps that we saw.
Yes.
A while ago?
Yes.
Because I think that's pretty powerful if people can say, oh, well, here's where my house is, and this is what the response time is going to be under these different scenarios. And then just include some more definitions, like the first service level and emergency response question is, what are the state mandates that FCFA needs to fund in strategic plan? Well, what's the strategic plan? I don't know what that is. So, maybe that could just be a link for more information on what is the strategic plan.
Is that on our website?
Maybe like have the first, like have FCFA, what it is, like strategic plan, just a little definition.
Yeah, I see, and even what's a mandate.
Things that we use mm-hmm. as.
Let's see. I'm not sure if there's any other definitions in there that might
really
need a little clarification. I did
what
notice
is divestiture? Some people might not.
And I think I got in there in terms of what does divestiture mean.
Yeah, I saw that one. I did notice that there's some places where it's divestiture and other places is divestiture. And
I got a typo.
I guess divestiture is like an archaic form, so make those consistent. That would be good.
I was thinking divest and divestiture were two different forms. Like,
well, divestiture and divesture. So divesture is an obsolete form of divestiture.
Sure. No, I got you.
So when are we going to see the answers?
It's just a list of
questions.
You're
just throwing a lot of questions at
Nobody
me
said anything
real
about
quickly
answers.
Here, and I'm getting lost because what are we going with, divestiture or divestiture? And I do see I used them both there. And then to the question of when are you going to see answers? Well, is there an inclination to have an ad hoc committee help with those
answers?
Answer a question with a question.
What Cynthia said about the strategic plan, that would go up here in the history, right? I think we've had that written out before.
Well, don't we have it on our homepage or whatever
right,
it is?
Right, for the questions, the history of the Oceano Fire, and then maybe the timeline of the Fire Authority, kind of like we've had that before.
Say that again?
The timeline of when the Fire Authority started. What?
Yeah, I know we've had that. Description of why it exists.
And that's part of the history and background
right.
discussion.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Will all volunteer to be on an ad hoc committee?
I can't be, but I can help.
Can't be on an ad hoc. Is that for what, after getting the answers?
The answers,
yeah. I'll do that. If you need an ad hoc committee.
In the under the service level and emergency response questions, you've got, does FCFA respond to emergencies outside the boundaries? Will a special tax make them respond to the beach and do respond to emergencies outside the county? That could all be almost one answer, maybe.
One question. Oh, I think we need a definition of what is CAL FIRE. Some people might, is it the county? Because people might, CAL FIRE, is that a state or is that a county? You know,
well,
kind of.
And that's true because isn't Cal, it's really the San Luis County, CAL FIRE acting as the San Luis Obispo County Fire Department.
I think that needs to be explained.
CAL FIRE, all caps, two words, state agency providing contract fire services to the county of San Luis Obispo.
Yeah, that's what we need to.
All caps?
Yes.
CAL and FIRE?
CAL Space FIRE?
Cap.
Yes.
Well, I like that too because I think Chief Gelbert was indicating that he's either managing 22 or 24 stations or 26 or something like that.
That needs to be, and how many there are in the county.
And I think that as part of a definition or saying who is CAL FIRE helps to illustrate that their, you know, responsibility is really a broader
and
jurisdiction
kind of
just than the three.
Is that CAL FIRE is a bigger, Chief Gelbert said that, remember that we're dealing with our communities, whereas we'd be absorbed into the big.
Lose local control and be part of it.
So my thought in terms of the timing is coming back to your board as we're addressing some of the questions. Like, so next meeting we can develop answers to some of the questions and just kind of keep it going. Because if we wait till we have answers to all of them, one, that's going to be a lot to absorb in one agenda item. But also we'll just, you know, it's going to take a while. It's going to take longer to answer all the questions than to come back in groups. So we can do that. The other reason why I think it's timely now is we want to make sure that all these questions we've developed answers to prior to your board calling for the election, because these are the types of questions that are also going to support findings by your board as to why you're calling for the question for the election.
Yeah. So everyone's important.
And then when completed, they can be on our website?
Yes.
And Facebook and
Nextdoor. I would imagine that some of our public outreach is going to including sending information in the mail. This is a different.
Good. We're going to have to get the Friends of the Five Cities Fire Authority maybe will be helping put together some outreach things.
So we, you know, that's got to be independent from your board.
Right.
Yeah.
But if people can, like, individuals can make banners and things, probably, you know, signs to, will there be like signs to put in people's yards if somebody wanted to make
them? If somebody buys them.
Yeah. Well, we have to
bake sale time.
Well, again, I'm going to ask your board to refrain from any thoughts on advocacy one way or another. Yeah.
Right. No, we won't.
Sorry.
So no formal direction necessary on this item. And if board members have additional thoughts, even after you go home or next week, of course, you can always email me, and I won't share your emails with the ad hoc committee, but they'll be in my mind as we continue with the discussions.
Public, is there any public comment on our... Yes, please. Come forward.
Dave Leffler. Just a thought. The more of this we can get out, the sooner, the better, I believe, because we all know we're going to need more money. And one of the important questions I didn't see here was how much more money per household. And to me, that's an important one when we're trying to figure out voting. Also, go ahead.
No, I think that's what, when will you do it now, figure out the amount of?
We're working on that right now. Yeah. And our surveyor has generally recommended that we come and have that detailed fiscal discussion when we bring the survey results back. If we talk about money too soon, their concern is that could taint the survey results.
Okay.
You know.
When will the survey be performed?
Need to get back to them. I don't have specific dates right now. What Jeff and I are doing is confirming draft ballot language, because they do want to have draft ballot language. So we've been confirming on election code provisions and just making sure that we provide this Godby research with a reasonably good ballot language, even though your board hasn't considered it yet, something that's going to be somewhat close to what the final ballot language would be. So I would anticipate we'll have that to them early next week, and we should be able to get a response to them on the dates that they'll be doing the survey.
Thank you. We're all anxious.
Well, thank you. We'll have it about the time the power goes out.
Okay, so we don't need I think we know what we're doing, right? Okay, I think that's it. Are we down to our miscellaneous? Any hearing items? Communications or written, late communications? Did he say no? Okay. And anything to report on future agenda items?
So again, next meeting, intending to bring the construction documents for North Swing Pershing project specifically, so that we can get that out to bid. The Highway 1 waterline replacement project is one where we've got grant funded for it. So that, and also Tony confirmed with Caltrans that they won't be doing that work until 2022. So we've got time on that one.
2022?
Yeah.
When? For which project?
For Highway 1. The AC overlay, the asphalt work.
Oh, North Swing. Right.
Yeah, no, the county's doing North Swing at the end of this year, early next year.
You'll be able to bail hay.
Caltrans had identified that they're going to be doing asphalt overlay work on Highway 1. They had earlier indicated that they thought they would be in 2020, but that's getting pushed off a couple of years. So we have time to work with that. It's the North Swing and Pershing one that time is sensitive on it. The other item that I want to make sure to get in front of your board relatively soon is the 2020 legislation regarding customer shutoffs, because that's going to change. And then following some of the local agency agendas, I've seen that it's on some of the other CSD agendas. So I'll work with Kerry and see what they've done. But basically, again, in 2020, our ability to shut off service for non-payment is going to fall under a whole new set of rules. So we're going to have to address that this fall, really in advance of those changes. And hopefully some of the other community services districts will have been doing good homework on that. But want to get that on the agenda pretty quickly as well.
Okay. Is there anything else? Do we want to just have a motion to adjourn?
I move we adjourn.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Okay. Sign checks.
We adjourn.
Thank you very much for coming, everyone.